Yes, hi. Safety message for today. First, we'll start with the emergency exits. Exit right up in the front on the left and on the right and in the back of the room. The meeting location for this area is across the street in the building museum, right on the front lawn. That's where we will meet. Safety contact for today. With today's impending weather, please use extra caution getting on and off the trains, using stairs or escalators due to the anticipated slippery conditions. On the other part of the presentation, this is on electrical safety and has to do with extension cords. This time of year, a lot of use of extension cords, some improper, some proper. There are over 4,000 injuries associated every year with extension cords, 3,300 residential fires, injuring 270 people and killing at least 50 every year. The frequent cause is the short circuits. So it has to do with the type of extension cord you use, the proper rating on the extension cords you use, and also where you place your extension cords. If not specifically designed for use behind furniture with the 90-degree angle on the plug to keep it away, you could fray the wires and cause an electrical hazard right behind a combustible item. Also, one of our bad habits is when you're in the house and you have something plugged in, you tend to pull on the cord instead of pulling the plug. And that weakens that connection and can cause quite a bit of additional hazards related to extension cords. That concludes the safety contact for today.
Thank you. We have the minutes from the November meeting. Are there amendments or changes to the minutes? If not, could we have a motion to approve? Second. Hearing no objection, the minutes are approved. We now have, for the first time under the committee's jurisdiction, a couple of action items that involve creating the safety framework within the agency, and I'll ask Jim Doherty to go through those items for our discussion and recommendation to the board.
Thank you, Chairman Downey. The first item that we're presenting to the Board Safety and Security Committee is an amendment to the System Safety Policy Statement. The last amendment was October 2006. The policy statement is part of the System Safety Program Plan and establishes the tone and direction for the authority to follow as related to safety. And as you can see here, it establishes three key objectives: avoid loss of life, injury, property damage, commitment to safety, identification, and analysis, mitigation, or hazard control, if you will. In addition to the direction and mission, it requires the authority to develop a system safety program plan and comply with our state safety oversight requirements, and in our case, the Tri-State Oversight Committee for Rail. To date, this is the fourth amendment to the board policy statement, and you can see the various past changes. Basically, this policy reflects organizational changes, reporting relationships, such as the chief safety officer reporting to the general manager, recognition of the board safety and security committee. In addition, overall, it strengthens the communications between WMATA and TOC, and these changes are consistent with FTA and MTSB recommendations. And you should have had the amended changes in a red line version in your package, and unless there are any questions, I'd ask that the committee consider recommending approval of this policy change.
There are questions or comments on the policy statement? I wanted to make one. I think one of the very significant elements of this, obviously, is that the board is enacting it. But as the statement indicates, it is recognized accountability for safety rests with each employee, supervisor, manager, and executive. It really starts cascading down the responsibility for safety, responsibility that each person in the agency has with respect to the elements in the safety plan. It's the plan for everybody. It's not just the plan for the safety department. It's not just what the board does. But we started off by saying this is the framework, and we will now be preparing and submitting that new safety plan, and I assume we'll hear from TOC later about how they will be ready to receive it and react to it. Can we have a motion to recommend this to the board?
So move.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries, and we will recommend it to the board this afternoon. And we have a second action item.
Yes, sir, Chairman Downey and members of the board. This is the TOC, or Tri-State Oversight Committee, and WMATA Memorandum of Understanding, and I believe you've had opportunities in the past to see what was actually in the mill is what we were doing. But to give you a little background, the salient point basically on this slide is a continuation of WMATA and the TOC to explore ways to strengthen our communications and sharing of information to ensure the safety of our customers, employees, and the communities that we serve. The purpose of the MOU specifically clarifies the roles and obligations of the parties. It establishes clear expectations and the time frames. It addresses NTSB concerns for improving TOC oversight of WMATA, and we believe it also will go forward in enhancing the safety and security of our riders. The requirements of, you know, we have the MOU, and then there's what's called the Tri-State Oversight Committee Program and Standards. The Program and Standards document is a little more, it complies with the federal regulations for state safety oversight of when you notify, what you notify, but the MOU actually better defines the partnership between WMATA and TOC, and it's a bilateral document. It clarifies the communication strategies and protocols of the existing TOC program standards. And, you know, as far as this says, it enhances certainly communication with the executive level of management, specifies the when, the hows, if you will, of when that communication goes forward, communication with the board, and how the TOC or the TOC executive committee would communicate with the board. The WMATA organizational structure, basically that the chief of police and chief safety officer report to the general manager, access to WMATA facilities, and then the general oversight. And one of the things that we know certainly is on major capital projects, there's a 10-day review period for the TOC for safety certification of various capital projects.
So that occurs after we certify the project. And its safety implications, and there goes over to them for review before the project moves forward.
It does, but they're also with us. They're working along with us as we're moving through the project,
yeah.
You know, from design, from preliminary engineering, through actual operational readiness, integration, testing.
But no new capital improvement goes into place until it's received a safety certification.
Correct. Major project,
right.
Yes, sir. It clarifies the access to information. And basically that WMATA shall provide TOC with copies of documents relevant to their established guidelines for reportable rail incidents and identified unacceptable hazardous conditions. Addresses dispute resolution. TOC may identify a condition or practice which could reasonably be expected to cause death if they were to cause death or serious physical harm and give WMATA notice to abate. And the TOC Executive Committee has the right to suspend or cancel funding to WMATA in the event that there is no satisfactory resolution of the identified problem. But the reality is we're all working together and we should never come to that point. So, but
TOC Executive Committee consists of the three transportation department heads in the jurisdictions.
That's
so in effect, we've given them a nuclear option.
Yes, sir.
Which hopefully doesn't get used. Yes.
That nuclear option you're referring to, you say we give them, but that essentially resides in federal law.
Yes.
So it's not we're giving it to them.
It's not new, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Now, under federal law, funding can be suspended for a variety of things, and occasionally that happens. It happened a couple of weeks ago in a city south of here.
Certainly, unless there's any questions, we would ask that the committee move to make a recommendation to approve the MOU.
Are there questions, discussion? I'd like to ask the general manager, are you comfortable with the ability to work within this framework?
Yes, in fact, it really represents a formalization of the process that has
grown over the last several months.
Mr. Chairman, we'll hear from talk later on in the meeting. Other comments?
I was making a motion.
I think this is an important step forward and the culmination of a lot of what we've been doing over about the last 12 months.
Your microphone on?
It is. The light is on, anyway. I think this is an important step forward, and I'm pleased that it is finally before us for approval, and I'd like to move that the committee recommend approval to the board.
Second.
Okay. Maybe I just made a motion, though. Okay. Okay. That's okay.
Any further discussion? Not.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to, in my earlier motion, I was saying thank you also. I didn't realize this was a lot of effort on all sides to come up with a workable process, and there were a lot of nuances and a lot of kinks to iron out. So I too want to at least commend the effort that was put in to come up with something workable, and so I would support the motion.
Other comments? Not all in favor of recommending the resolution to the board, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Ayes have it, and we will recommend it this afternoon. We'll move on to the information component of the agenda. We've kind of set a pattern here. 1 month, we'll really focus on Metro Safety Department and just pick up on security. To a lesser extent, a second month will feature security, and then in accordance with our agreement, the third month would be a report from the Tri-State Oversight Committee. This is now the third month, so we're happy to have Matt Bassett here. Also very happy we have your slides. Those of us who can't see far enough to see the screen can follow along in the songbook.
Certainly. Thank you, Chairman Downey. I appreciate the opportunity, as always, to present here on behalf of the Tri-State Oversight Committee to just provide a brief update on some of our activities, both internal and with WMATA management and safety. Just the most significant activity we've conducted this year, just as a quick update. As you know, we're required to review WMATA's safety and security programs through an evaluation of their system safety program plan, as well as their security and emergency preparedness plan, on a 3-year basis as a real comprehensive top-to-bottom review. And, you know, there are smaller reviews in WMATA's internal audits that occur in between those 3-year reviews. WMATA's proposed corrective action plans went over on schedule to us on November 22nd. We reviewed them, reviewed them, and we will be transmitting our approval or, you know, it does say rejection, but there's really not anything that's going to get rejected because all of WMATA's proposals were pretty good. And those will be coming over, it says December 22nd, it will probably be Friday afternoon. And that provides our stamp of approval for the proposed course of action that the authority has laid out to address these areas of concern so that we will be able to monitor their implementation of them in the fashion that they propose. There may be some, you know, tweaks of we need a date on this one or we need a specific person on the other one, but we're pretty much there.
So as we've talked about in the last couple of months, once that occurs, our inventory of corrective action plans will get much larger.
It will.
But hopefully begin to shrink fairly quickly.
It will. And I think the organizational attitude towards them has been to develop corrective action plans that are manageable in scope, that they haven't been. We had initial concerns that there might be some very big kind of super corrective action plans, and that certainly hasn't happened. They've been addressed individually, and I think what you'll see is regular and incremental progress in addressing them. The internal safety audit program is continuing at an appropriate pace. As you may remember, WMATA submitted an internal safety audit recovery plan as part of their response to the March 4th final audit report from the Federal Transit Administration. There were some initial hiccups a few months ago about the on-time submittal of checklists, but those have been resolved. And our only placeholder on this is we need to ensure that when WMATA internally conducts a safety or security audit and evaluates a certain operating department, that there's a timely handshake between the auditors and the auditees, I suppose, in developing an acceptable response to the findings. And we've had discussions with the WMATA Safety Department staff on that. We're confident they're moving forward at an appropriate pace on that one.
And I'm aware of one such audit that is in that process. I think I've just seen the corrective action plans, but assume you will see them shortly.
Do you know which particular department that is?
Just the track and structures. And
okay. Yes. I think we're probably going to be seeing those soon as well. WMATA's roadway worker protection program. I correct myself because the new term is roadway worker protection. I don't want to be contradicting myself. The NTSB has requested one minor revision to the program, and I believe WMATA has accepted that and is going to make the appropriate changes. The overall approach we concur with, as long as they can sustain, as long as they can reach adequate levels of participation in the training classes, we think they'll be on target at the pace that they've selected. What our concern is that it's been difficult, given that they have to run an operating railroad, to get all of the necessary line personnel into these classes. And our hope is that they've just begun training probably the most essential component of it, which is level four, which is the roadway worker in charge, essentially the supervisory level of roadway worker protection. And with that, has just gotten off the ground in the last week or two as planned. But over the next weeks and months, we will be closely monitoring the level of participation within their RWP training classes to ensure that once the training deadline is up, that there is an adequate core of trained personnel. And as long as that the training efforts ramp up to the right place, we think that they're on the right path.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question?
Sure.
Like, this is really for the general manager. Have we made any accommodations or have made any changes to our message to our managers in terms of trying to get more people to these training programs?
It's been made clear to the management that that has to be done, and more particularly what goes on here is a balance between actual maintenance and making people available for training. And Mr. Kubitschek has made a commitment, which I know will be met, to balance the maintenance against the training so that the people are trained by the deadline.
Line of thinking here. Is the training required? Is there some certification that our employees must have in order to continue in their line of employment?
They need to pass this training or to have access to do the work on the track, so it's required. But it's really up to management to make sure they get there. And that's what Dave is focused on. We'll make sure it happens.
Well, no one is out on working on track. Once all the training is done, everybody is out there working. Will it?
Yeah. Currently, they're working under the current standards, and these are obviously upgraded standards, and they will be all upgraded.
Regarding accident investigation recoveries, to the quick refresher, that there were a series of open accident investigations dating back, I think, as early as this year. They dated back to 2004. There was one left from 2004, and those have been closed out all the way up until 2007, which is very encouraging. As the FTA audit report noted, they requested that WMATA develop an accident investigation recovery plan, essentially laying out goals and timelines by which they would address the backlog of accident investigation reports. Just on an informational basis, the open accident investigations didn't mean that no one did any reports whatsoever. What it generally tended to mean was that the information that was collected either never made it to the safety department or it never made it to us a couple of years ago. And so I think it's worth commending the current safety department and management for the detective work that they've been doing over the last few months in digging up these reports and information on some incidents that were reportable by the federal standard that we operate under, but may not have been, you know, presented to us with all of the boxes checked that we needed. The accident investigation recovery plan that was submitted laid out some deadlines and some goals for addressing outdated incidents, and some of those have not been met. And I think part of it was that there was a WMATA took a very aggressive approach to implementing this report, this recovery plan, which is commendable. Some of the, as we had in discussion with safety staff and the general manager yesterday, they've indicated that some of the reports that appear to be low-hanging fruit had very, in fact, had very little on them available that they could dig up. The flip side of that is that there were a number of incidents within the accident investigation recovery plan that they had not planned to address as quickly as they, in fact, have. So the discussion that we had yesterday after the slides were complete was that they're going to be revising the accident investigation recovery plan, and we're satisfied with that course of action.
Ask one terminology question. Can you give me the distinction between a corrective action plan and a recovery plan?
Sure. A corrective action plan, the federal standard, 49 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 659, requires that rail transit agencies who take federal money as part of their system safety efforts develop corrective action plans and submit them to state safety oversight organizations when they have a finding from an internal or an external safety or security audit, when they detect an unacceptable hazardous condition, you know, on a number, anywhere where they detect a recognizable safety deficiency that requires an organizational response.
It gets documented and then followed through with that.
Yeah. Right, and it requires, you know, a cracked rail or a pull apart does not constitute something requiring a corrective action plan, but something
fixing, but not a plan.
Yeah, it requires fixing, but it doesn't require the involvement of the state safety oversight. A recovery plan, on the other hand, is a term of art that we first saw when the Federal Transit Administration issued their audit in March 4th, which essentially said, you know, there has been a backlog, and it was addressed to us as well. As you know, WMATA was asked to develop it, but we were asked to review and approve it, and it essentially said there has been a backlog of program activities in a certain area of your responsibilities under 659, and please lay out a course of action over a period of time by which you will address this backlog. And
so these are more systemic in nature as opposed to specific.
Yes.
Yeah.
They are. The idea is to bring a specific program activity back up to speed, rather than addressing any one individual deficiency.
Thank you.
Unless there's others. FTA, as I mentioned, the Federal Transit Administration did conduct an audit both of TOC and WMATA in December of 2009, and they issued their final audit report March 4th. This slide, actually, I'll take responsibility for this. I needed to update it with some additional dates. We provided our most recent submission to FTA on October 15th, as well as a full submittal of all of the audit materials we put together to the NTSB. Our open recommendation from the NTSB is to satisfactorily address both all of our open findings from the March 4th report, as well as to work with WMATA to get theirs addressed. We submitted ours on the 15th and went to the NTSB on the November 2nd, and we got a response from FTA yesterday, in fact, saying that they're going to want to set up a joint work session with WMATA and the TOC to go over their response to our submittal. So we look forward to that, and our goal is to satisfactorily address all of their findings and concerns, and I know that WMATA's goal is the same. There was a brief mention that I think probably fits best under here of the WMATA System Safety Program Plan. As you may know, we have been revising our system safety program standard and procedures, which lay out the framework by which WMATA implements their system safety program plan. We had a very productive working session with WMATA going over how we plan to revise our program standard, incorporated their comments and input, and they're working on the significant task of overhauling their entire system safety program plan. And by all indications we have available to us, they are on time and on target for completing that document in January, which is when we will have our revised program standard procedures as well. Regarding just the recent VTX report and some escalator safety concerns, the WMATA's report commissioned with their contractor VTX reinforced similar conclusions that we met in our triennial safety and security audit. In particular, concerns over compliance with the preventive maintenance program and with ensuring that escalators were maintained on the planned schedule, as well as ensuring that the maintenance that took place was up to WMATA's internal standards. There have been a number of activities taking place over the last month and a half, both including talk in the safety department, including participation in some training and information sessions, just so we get a better understanding of the problem that we're dealing with. And just based on a discussion yesterday, WMATA is planning to submit corrective action plans from the VTX report on safety-related findings from that report. And that is, to us, perhaps the most important program management response to it, because we believe that's consistent with the requirements of 659, and that will give us an opportunity to review the plans and timeframes and evaluate them and ultimately approve them. Yes, the implementation of that is obviously key, as it is with the other corrective action plans that we deal with. We continue to participate in some of WMATA's major projects, including their partnership on the Dulles extension and the 7000 series procurement. The slide notes that we could use more technical data, but has been made. We've been enlightened by the railcar engineering staff that essentially the technical data we have available to us, which is in their current request for proposal and technical specifications, is pretty much what's available at the moment, and that down the line, when they, get further into their design review, we'll have more to look at, and we're perfectly satisfied with that. I wanted to ensure that we include an applause line for the Executive Safety Committee and the participation and engagement that's been going on there. I think the Executive Safety Committee's ancestor, which was the SSEC, had a lot of shortcomings in addressing its mission, which was to review major accidents, to address concerns that percolated up from the local safety committees, to promote coordination between internal operating departments to address safety deficiencies. And it's really worth noting in a public forum that especially over the last few months, the participation of the most senior levels of management, including Mr. Sarles and Mr. Kubitschek and Mr. Doherty, have really realized the original charter of this. And we're very pleased to be an invited observer to this. And the only caveat I would include is that the progress has been, laudable, but we just need to ensure that it's sustained.
Mentioned earlier, this cascading down of responsibility, the very first place after the board is the general manager and this committee. I think it's very important that we do maintain that focus from the top, which will push everybody in the right direction.
One other thing that's worth noting is in terms of hazardous conditions, we have seen a few wrong side door incidents in which an operator has opened the door on the wrong side of the train while servicing a platform. And our concern is, of course, that this indicates problems with procedural adherence. You need to open, you know, the door on the appropriate side of the train, and it's obviously a safety critical issue and carries with it a hefty suspension if the operator's caught. But in some discussions that we've had with both railcar maintenance and the chief engineer for vehicles office, they made it clear that the operation of the operation of manual doors is necessary to, as they work on a fix to shield the automatic door operation from electromagnetic interference. So we're satisfied with the fact that that the technical solution to this problem is on the horizon, but what we'll need to continue for the foreseeable future are a strong program of efficiency checks and continued training to ensure that the human factor is addressed to the greatest degree possible. We understand that human beings are human beings and they make mistakes, but we will keep this on our radar screen to ensure that the efficiency check program is addressing that. We initially had some difficulty getting engaged in the automated train control system monitoring efforts, specifically WMATA's development of their track circuit monitoring tool, which is a system that's already in place but is being refined. Pleased to note that the WMATA management got very engaged on our behalf and provided the access not only that we needed but that the safety department needed as well. That occurred in the last 2 or 3 months. And we've been brought up to speed as recently as yesterday on some internal WMATA meetings going on to cross-pollinate between – there's a number of different ATC improvement efforts going on out there, and we're looking forward to participating in those. So as of right now, we don't have any unmet needs on this matter, and we appreciate the support that we've gotten thus far.
Just on that subject, this was one of the key recommendations from the National Transportation Safety Board that we do the total scrub of the train control system with careful effort. I have had a chance to see the scope of work with the consultant, and I would expect at some point, as the consultant's work goes forward, we get some review with this committee about what the policy and resource implications are of their findings.
The other sort of housekeeping details is that for our internal operations, we're going to establish a phone line that's going to be accessible to the public if they have, and the safety department has set up a very robust hotline by which employees can report safety concerns. And we certainly don't intend to duplicate their efforts in any way, but, you know, there have been concerns voiced in the public sphere in the past about how the TOC didn't have a phone number. We have what we consider to be a pretty functional website at the moment, which is an improvement over our previous electronic presence, and we think this will just provide an additional mechanism for communication. We're also going to set up a 24-hour, I hesitate to call it a call center, but an answering service so that when a WMATA safety officer has an incident but by federal regulation they're required to notify the TOC of, instead of, you know, let's say I happen to be back home in Massachusetts where my cell phone service is not the best, they don't have to go down the list of all the TOC members before they get a person. They will have a one phone number, one point of contact, and that will put them immediately in touch with the on-call TOC person, which we really hope.
Once they've made that call, we've fulfilled our responsibility. It really becomes TOC's responsibility to get the message.
Yes. Once the actual handshake is made over the phone between the on-call safety officer or, you know, whomever it is from WMATA,
yeah,
reporting the incident within the prescribed 2-hour time period, then it becomes our responsibility to turn around and get the other TOC members up to speed. And generally it tends to be, we have this incident, these are the basic facts that we know, and we'll talk to you later when we know, because we certainly don't expect a comprehensive accident investigation report in that time frame.
I remember getting those kinds of calls in the past, always at inconvenient hours, inconvenient places.
They rarely happen during bankers' hours now. The other thing that's worth noting is we've been pleased to have TOC personnel, including myself, participate on some of the Federal Transit Administration's working groups addressing, in particular, state safety oversight and what the kind of next-generation model will be for it. And we continue to participate with the on system security and emergency preparedness with the Transit Police and the Office of Emergency Management. In fact, as recently as yesterday, the Office of Emergency Management, in response to an area of concern from our triennial, submitted a significant amount of documentation allowing us to review a lot of their emergency operations plans and procedures to address our concerns, and we appreciate their cooperation and engagement with our program. And I certainly make myself available for any questions you might have, and that's the web address.
Are there questions from the committee members on the talk presentation, Ms. Hutchins?
Yes.
Hey, what you mean by human factors, or are you speaking of employee, or are you speaking of customers?
Well, I was referring to employee, but I think you bring up the important point that customers play a role in this as well. When there are individuals who, you know, may put their hands in the doors to hold it for their friends as if it's an elevator, that obviously creates an additional problem. What I was referring to was that given that the current operating requirement of the system is that they have to operate the doors in manual, there has to be a human in the loop opening and closing them. Anytime there is a solely human responsibility, there is the opportunity for human performance problems. And that's what we have when we have the wrong side door incidents where the doors open on the wrong side of the platform. And our concern is mostly just that the efficiency checks necessary are conducted. We don't believe that, and that the hazard is mitigated to the lowest degree practical. We don't believe that it's reasonable to expect it will ever completely disappear, but given that it is a safety critical item, that it will be mitigated as low as possible until that fix comes in down the road to allow the return to automatic door operations.
And I guess the reason I ask that is, how do we separate the two so that we can ensure that, one, you have the operation occurring at its most efficient rate, and then we must quantify for, guess what, the proverbial intentional hands in the door, leaning on the door, all those things that most often take the cars out. My experience, and I'm living it today, the experience seemingly is more often the human intervention of the crowded cars, leaning on doors, and those things. So
we tend to pay not a great deal of attention to the arms in the door incidents, simply because they tend to be more of an operating inconvenience and take the trains out of service rather than posing a really significant safety hazard, as opposed to opening the doors on the wrong side. You expose individuals to fall hazards in the third rail. I think that the one is the wrong side door issue is an employee outreach and training and efficiency check concern, whereas the arms in the door is really more of a public outreach kind of thing. But that's just a...
I can report that the operator on my train this morning, and I've heard him before, is very firm but gentle in getting that message across. And it helps. Other questions? Go ahead.
Let me just say, I found the presentation today to be very focused and very helpful. And I think this relationship between the TOC and the board and the committee itself is on firm ground. I think the way the report was presented, the format was very concise but also very helpful. The dialogue that's taking place has been very helpful. So I think this is a moving on the right track right now, and commend you for that.
Thank you. We certainly concur.
Any other questions or comments? No. Thank you very much, Mr. Bassett. We really appreciate your report and what you do every day. Mr. Doherty, the safety report, in the interest of time, will be brief, but hit the highlights and a couple of follow-up items to last month that you're going to report on.
Yes, sir. Well, Chris, go right to the next slide. Just to provide you a briefing, since 2004, we've assigned 256 corrective action plans. Of those now to date, 89% or 230 of those are now closed. This provides you the breakdown of the plans by year. Just a reminder that the two aging ones that are from 2004, that's the external door handles and the rollback protection, so those will take some time. But we are definitely moving ahead. As you see, 2005, 2006 is closed out. 2010 has one open, but as Mr. Bassett's mentioned, there'll be a few more added that you'll see before the next committee meeting. Next slide. We wanted to highlight those operations that continue to excel. That is those that have worked over 300 days without a workers' comp injury with cost. As you can see, as of November 30th, we're up to, at Glenmont with 1,313 days. And then the most recently added service maintenance with 300. So we do have eight groups that are excelling, and we're definitely pleased with that. At the board's request, you had asked that we provide you with some of the higher rates. So these are the 10 groups with the higher rates from 9.32 to 19.24. And that metric is based on 200 man hours or 100 employees working for the course of a normal year. And as an example, the Southern Avenue Annex experienced 19 accidents per 100 employees for the work year. So it provides you another look.
And it provides you a lead as to where your efforts might well be focused.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes.
Question on that one. Is there a benchmark you're looking at when you look at figures like that?
The typical benchmark from a corporate level is about
6.1. 6.1.
So that's nationally if you look at all industry. What we're going to do is quickly move through. Actually, we've included in your packet, but to make sure that where I'm able to follow along, we've actually would move through the total rail incidents. Those stay static at 19. Rail passenger injuries, suicides. I think it's certainly important to note through December 15th. In November, we've had zero, and for the first half of December, zero. So this is actually a 55% reduction compared to last year and right in line with 2008. So we're going to move to the next slide, the total bus collision rate.
Yes, I'm sorry. Mr. Graham had a question.
So there have been, this is actually very good news. So there have been no suicides or presumably attempted suicides.
Well, we did have an attempted individual that actually has survived and is still surviving, and that was October 30th, I believe.
So since the 1st of August, there has been one attempt. I just want to be clear on what the number is. There's one attempted suicide and no suicide.
That's correct to the best of my knowledge. We've had people fall off the platforms, but not suicide attempts. So one attempt, yes, sir, since August.
Is there any, you don't have to answer this question now, but I would be interested in checking with the folks who are advising us on this, but whether there might be a theory as to why this has dropped off. I just would be interested, you don't have to answer now, but if you get back to us, because we do have professional consultations on this.
And suicides do tend to run in waves.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to comment on, we did pass through some slides there quickly, but certainly if there's questions, we'll.
Mr. Chairman, actually, I did have a question. If you could go back on one of the slides that you were skipping on the fire incidents.
Yes, sir.
And smoke incidents. Obviously, the fire incidents are down. I'm sorry, are up by 2, and smoke incidents are down. I'm sorry, up by 20. Smoke incidents are down. Is this smoke turning to fire, and is this an issue of response time, or why would they reverse like that?
Okay, the smoke incidents are typically like train brakes, smoldering, wheezy bonds, cross ties, things along that line. The fires typically have been insulator related. We've had some recent light fixtures, and we're working, actually the rail operations group is working on getting the debris off of, you know, light fixtures or potential hot sources. So, you know, the brakes are kind of, I'd say, you know, looking at more of the smoke, and the fires are more of the lighting and the insulators
and things along that line.
Okay, so the smoke incidents are not, we should not construe those as necessarily candidates for fire issues. They may not be correlated.
They may not, and all, but they also could, depending on the circumstances. If, you know, if it's caught before, you know, it turns into a fire, you know, potentially, you know, with newspapers, if they're smoking before we actually have flames. So there's that potential in that case, but we are working on the debris. David, do you want to add?
And I'd also like to add that in 2008, we were funded to do, like, weed control, spraying, and everything else. 2009, we were put in a position that that service was cut, and we knew, you know, there was going to be a risk of that. 2010, we reshifted some stuff, deferred some things, because we knew that this was going to, you know, come back to create issues. That's also part of the reason why we do have all three vacuum trucks and stuff that are on there, so we're in a catch-up mode, but we are now, you know, trying to maintain weeds, limbs, debris, and keep things, you know, picked up as much as possible. And we do have the equipment now deployed within the last 90 days, which we did not have, you know, 6 months ago.
Okay. Move to the total bus collision rate. The bus collision rate is up slightly, as are the associated injuries as well, primarily due to the incidents that we discussed last month, from September, the one that involved the fire truck and the bus on bus in the previous months. As I've mentioned in the bus passenger accident rates, you certainly can see the peak from September from those two particular incidents, although now we are back down in line, like in October, with 10 occurrences compared to that.
Zach? Bus passenger industries. Injuries?
Yes, sir. And that was, you know, that gives you basically here you have a pretty much close to a six-year view, and beyond that, our data is pretty sketchy, so we're working on getting that all together. Unless there were questions, I was going to, didn't have anything, you know, real significant to tell you, certainly, on the previous slide. So moving to the pedestrian, and whoops, Chris, you're going a little too fast for me. With that, as you can see, there were no pedestrian injury or incidents in October. We have had a couple here in December, but I believe October and November. So it is a favorable trend with a 44 or 47% reduction. Metro access, certainly there, you know, we have the slide on metro access, but we're using the same metrics now for the per million miles, and it's yielding basically a higher rate given the change in the denominator. Move then to the employee injury rate, and as noted earlier, we're attempting to normalize our data as opposed to just the raw numbers, so we're actually providing you a rate, and you can see actually this year we are trending down just a little bit at 6.21 per 200,000 man hours compared to 6.71 last year. Unless there's any questions or
concerns. Well, you just had a chart there. It says escalator update, but there's no information in our packet. All right, okay.
I actually wanted to follow up on slide 41, which Mr. Giancola asked the question. These are the workers' compensation rates per 200,000 hours. And you mentioned the benchmark related to the Southern Avenue bus facility. I'm curious as to, I can't understand this chart unless I understand the benchmarks for all of these types of facilities. And I may have the wrong page. I'm looking for the horizontal graph, but it's hard to understand this chart unless you understand what the industry benchmark or national standard is, how we're doing in these areas, and so that's the right chart. Obviously, there's different jobs and different requirements in each of these facilities that could be contributors to the rate, and unless we know where we stand against peers, it's hard to tell how we're doing in any of these categories, and so I would just request, and we don't need a long conversation about it today, but I would request when we see this chart in the future that we be given some type of idea of what the national benchmark is so that we can see where we might actually have a problem. The one that was mentioned were significantly higher than the benchmark. I'm not sure that that's the case in all of these facilities and would like to see that so that we can measure really how we're doing against what the national average is.
We can certainly provide that.
You told us about warranty, but the other question is whether or not it's a skill set for a particular area within a bus garage
where there are people to work rather than just the garage itself.
It could be those that are working in maintenance of bus repair. So the compensation rates in a particular skill set could also give you some indication whether there's safety hazards or issues related to that particular crack versus just location of the facility.
It is, and we can provide you the transportation versus maintenance. If I could, for Southern Avenue, and we do have programs that we're working on with bus. Southern, actually, their 19 incidents include 11 from collisions, 9 from strains, 4 from slips and falls that have been reported, 3 were assaults, 3 were stress, 2 were struck by something, 2 were cut by something, 1 was a cut, and even 1 we had was bitten by an insect. So it takes in quite a gamut. The majority actually are injuries resulting from collisions for the Southern Avenue. But we can give you the benchmarks because there is a maintenance as well as there's the transportation. There's overall industry that's provided, but then but a lot of that data that comes from the federal government, from like the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is normally 2 to 3 years old. But we certainly can look at that and provide you that from OSHA.
Good, and actually that was the bag of worms I was hoping to open because I think we need to understand a lot better, you know, what's happening here, because there may be incidents or specific job areas within these facilities that we need to focus on and drill down on, and that's something the board needs to know so that we can chart a course forward to improve these numbers.
Okay, and what we provide you, you know, the raw number in parentheses, I said that is 43, but you take like the service vehicle, there's vehicle maintenance, that's 5 incidents, you know, and 2 of those are slips and falls. 1 was struck, so, but we can, and that's why we're giving you the runners. You can see, even though the rate's 15.63, which, you know, we're always striving for 0 accidents, so no accidents acceptable, but that takes into account 5 incidents. But we're working with, you know, the maintenance groups, the transportation groups to drive these numbers down, focusing on the data that we have available, using that as we go forward and work on that, but then we can also provide you the benchmarks to the best we can get them from either the statistics provided by OSHA or the National Safety Council.
Yes, now recognizing that a lot of these indicators are new and this committee is new and we're trying to get through this information, I think there's a larger question here about benchmarks in general. And if you look at many of these indicators, we're looking at this either year over year or comparing to previous quarters. Some of these have industry standards that we can benchmark these to. So I think we just need a better, at some point in time after we get used to looking at these numbers, I think we really need to ask those questions, how we're doing compared to other peer transit agencies, and also how we're dealing with these outliers. Because I also think, like, if you have a 6.1 incident rate on this particular graph here, I think those are outliers, and then what are we doing in terms of corrective action? So I just think that's a larger discussion for this committee that we should have at some point.
We'll put that on a future agenda to sort of establish where we are relative to various measures. Escalators?
Thank you. I'd ask FOG Deputy Chief Rail Bob Manishko to provide you an update on the 10-8-9.
Get the chief seat.
The escalator update we're about to provide is for Tenley Town. At the request of Mr. Sarles, the safety department launched an investigation into an incident that occurred on November 16th at Tenley Town Station on escalator number 7, which is one of 3 escalators at that location within the station. If I were to give you a layout, if you were looking up the escalator, the one to the right would be 5, the middle one would be 6, the one to the left would be number 7. At 4:11 p.m. and 34 seconds, which will give you an idea of timestamp, 14 customers proceeded to ascend escalator number 7, which, because it was under repair at the time, had step treads removed near the top of the unit. When the customers reached the open step area, they had to climb over a 4-foot opening where the step treads had been removed. A subsequent review of the station video revealed that at approximately 4:11, a VersaGuard accordion-style barrier was removed from the base of escalator number 7 at the station. The barrier was moved to the base of escalator number 5 by an individual that appears to have been a Metro employee. Neither escalator number 7 nor escalator 5 was running at the time. The individual remained in front of escalator 5 until the unit was clear of patrons. He then keyed the escalator on, removed the barrier to the adjacent wall, and left the base of the escalator by the way of the now ascending escalator. The customers also then began using this ascending escalator. The removed barrier caused a hazardous condition that allowed customers to ascend up the service area unimpeded. At approximately 4:15 p.m., a customer came down escalator number 6 and placed a cone that had been located in between escalator 6 and 7 the whole time in front of escalator 7 to protect the public. A different employee descended escalator 6 at about 4:19 and restored the VersaGuard barrier back to its original position in front of escalator number 7. There were no injuries reported in the incident. The information that's contained in this report was compiled from a statement that was provided by a Mr. Michael Murphy and was received by our Office of Inspector General's hotline on November 16th. And then we reviewed the video. The initial conclusions is that the root cause of this incident is the removal of the barrier that protected the out-of-service escalator from being accessed by Metro's internal and external customers. The contributing causes were that there was no way to secure the VersaGuard barrier to the escalator. The out-of-service status of the escalator should be clearly communicated to all employees, and that no employee should ever remove a protective device without first ensuring it is safe to do so. What are we doing to prevent reoccurrence? The Elevator Escalator Group is researching an attachment that exists for the VersaGuard barrier that allows it to be clamped to the escalator to prevent removal. Signage is also being improved to include an out-of-service date and the anticipated return-to-service date. It should be noted there was a sign on this VersaGuard, but it was pretty small, about 1x1. A redundant barrier is also being considered, 1 foot by 1 foot, thank you, sir. I have good ears, I don't have good eyes. A redundant barrier is also being considered that can be placed closer to the area where the work is being performed in case this were to happen again. Additional consideration, a review should be conducted within WMATA's management staff about how to report and follow up on safety concerns that they may receive from customers or others. In this instance, a number of people were made aware of the incident, but did not recognize the immediacy of the issue, nor was it clear to them to whom to report the incident for action. Following the review, it is recommended that clear direction be provided to all management about how to quickly follow up on such customer safety issues.
Let me just say, I was struck by your comment that the video revealed that the barrier was removed by someone that appeared to be a WMATA employee. Have we any further information as to, one, was that a WMATA employee and who the employee was?
We made phone calls to the station management. We had all divisions look at this. The problem was the grainy image. And for me to come and say it was definitely, I do not like to put out something that's not factual. The person had a radio. The person had a key because they keyed the escalator back on. Is it 99% sure that it's a woman? Yes, but that 1%, and that's why I would not use the word definitely.
Yeah, I was just trying to find out if there's any way of determining who the WMATA employee was in terms of who's assigned, what's the workstation, what are the variables that would give you some idea. I know the granular film might not have been the best to give you an accurate, but, you know, who would have a key, who would be in that facility, who's a likely person to have been in that area.
They do have a log within the kiosk of any repairs that are done to the escalator and elevators and when the individuals show up at the location. That the escalator elevator repairmen also report through Maximo, which we've reported on LaFont, where at this time there were elevator escalators people near the station up until 2 o'clock working on that service. That service, by the way, was brake repairs in response to LaFont, is what they were doing. So they were there till 2. This happened at 4:10. And there was a shift change also going on between the individuals in the station transportation group at that time. So to zero in, we're trying, but I, because of that grainy video, to clearly identify who it is, I haven't been able to do it.
And this is a further question related to video. Is the quality of the video an issue ongoingly? Was it just at that location, or does the quality of our video fail to provide us with that information on an ongoing basis?
Could you?
At this stage, it's the original video that's installed, you know, in this system, and we are going through a rehab, you know, project installing, you know, new cameras and everything else. So it's existing infrastructure from day one. We're definitely, as we're moving forward with the new equipment that we're installing, we're getting much better definition, much better resolution, but it's existing equipment that's at work.
Okay. And it is both an important safety and security tool that we should be using.
Yeah. And I also would like to add that, you know, with us on the note of, you know, upgrading our video system, it'll be a several years project. It's not something that's just going to happen, you know, very quickly and stuff, but we are moving to much more improved equipment with definitely better definition for us.
Is that on? I really appreciate these reports that we've been getting on these very detailed reports on escalator elevator issues, but I'm just a wee bit puzzled why we're not getting them in writing. You know, we get so many reports in writing, often in great detail, and yet when we reach this particular area, which is of enormous concern to so many people, we're asked to just kind of follow along as best we can. Why are we not getting written? This is, I only mention this because it's the second time. The last time I was sitting over there and I was able to commandeer the report. But do you remember that? But my colleagues weren't close enough to arm wrestle me over it, and so I was the only one who had it. So why aren't we being more forthcoming about this?
Well, we're trying to be forthcoming by presenting it, but in response to your comment, which we are updating this investigation right up to the last minute, but in the future, what we will do is the oral report that's being given to the committee we'll give to the The report that's being given to the committee will also give them the writing just before the meeting, so you have the most updated information.
And let me on the heels of what you've just said, let me add that if it's premature to give a report, I think we'd all understand that there shouldn't be a report. But right now we're kind of in a netherworld of a kind of quasi-report that if you listen very carefully, you can follow, maybe many of us can follow, But if you're not, you know, it's hard to follow without a written document. So if we could just go one way or the other, if you say we're looking at this, we're not ready to make a public statement or give us something in writing, one way or the other.
Actually, probably very often it'll be the in-between thing where we haven't fully completed the investigation, but I think we're far enough along that we should provide that information to the committee, and we will give you a written copy so you can everybody can follow along during the oral presentation.
Thank you.
I guess I'd like a little bit more connection between Mr. Linton's question as to the personnel involved and the responsibilities at that location. You talked about that the escalator repair people log in, as well as the station transportation people are there. And I guess what I'd like to understand, is there a relationship that is, a repair is going on, shouldn't that person be checking in with the kiosk folks? And what did you learn from that in terms of those folks? I guess I'm not clear on your response.
I'd like to address that question. What we're finding here is that our station managers do have keys, and they're always encouraged that if we have something that comes offline or is halted, that they go in and they try to reattempt to restart it and stuff, you know, if it's possible. We don't have customers and stuff that are, you know, in on the S unit and everything else. But at the same point in time, we have, as you see throughout the system, we have a lot of barricades, different types, different configurations. We also have maintenance staff that is working out there that's our maintenance staff, as well as we do have contractors that are also doing our heavy repairs. So earlier in the presentation, or the oral representation was, what we're looking at is figuring out a device to clamp in place so that way we can kind of segregate, is this a major repair that's in place towards it actually require some type of tool or equipment, which a station manager would not readily, you know, have access to, you know, accidentally, you know, doing something, which they were trying to do is to reset it. And then from there is also looking at our documentation and communication between the logs of, you know, the actual work and stuff that's taking place. But our main thrust right now is different signage, something that's not as easily removable, and a little bit different protocol between those individuals. And again, it's also the ongoing retraining, you know, making sure that the station managers understand their responsibility and role as far as reporting it, and definitely making the effort to reset these, as well as the maintenance staff to get out there and address them properly.
Yeah, well, not related to this particular committee, when we have our operations committee report, which will get a more detailed review of the escalator conditions, I'd like to have some indication and preparation, and also at that meeting to give us some idea of what the status of the repairs are, for one, associated with the follow-on to the L'Enfant incident. Also, what percentage of scheduled maintenance we're doing now. In other words, you have a schedule. Are we meeting that schedule? I'd like to get some indication of that. And also, the kinds of hours we're spending on this. Are crews working on Saturdays, for instance? Are they working when we close stations? You know, when we actually close, physically have closed stations, are they working during those periods when we're everything's out of service to do these kinds of repairs? So this is in preparation for the next operations committee meeting.
Just one question that comes to mind. I read with interest the Washington Post story that was on the Moscow escalators. And one of the things that came through in that article, differentiating us from them, was the fact that there was just so many more employees committed specifically to the, was it 3,000? And I just would be interested, pardon me?
One-third of our entire staff.
But I mean, that's, you know, but on the other hand, their escalators were operating seemingly to a much greater extent than ours. I mean, did you have any reactions to that?
Yeah.
Very positively.
We're going to get a fund match.
If you could get me to a third of that number, I would be very appreciative.
So you would agree that that's the principal difference?
I believe that would be not only was the staffing very nice, but it was also the in-house resources and their ability for engineering and everything else where they take control of it in-house. So anything that y'all could do to accommodate to that level of standard would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because I do want to mention that they had their own factory, actually, to produce yeah. parts. Which
and their own escalator monitors at each station watching them.
And 100% federal subsidy.
And when we buy gas and fill up our cars, we are helping to pay for their subway.
Yes.
Think about it.
Yes, right. And by the way, their escalators, if you've ever used them, are remarkable. They run at about 3 times the speed of the ones here as well.
Not allowed by our
I know.
Is the outstanding job that the New Orleans Joint Terrorism Task Force did. But more importantly than that, it is the actions of a citizen who witnessed something on a Facebook, who brought it to the attention of the FBI, which caused this whole activity to take place. On December 6th, Awas Yanis was arrested and charged with communicating threats using interstate communications in violation of U.S. code. In his threats, he indicated that he was willing to blow up certain areas in the National Capital Region to include the Georgetown area as well as a train specifically. Based upon that threat, search warrants were obtained, and he was arrested on December 6th and charged with those particular crimes. And it just indicates that to see something, say something. So it's very important that we alone can't be the solution to all of our problems, but collectively all of us can aid law enforcement in making sure that this system and all systems across the country were safe. And at no time were any employees, patrons, or facilities here at the Washington Metro ever in danger. And we, again, had a detective assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force here in Washington, D.C., and were aware of the case from the inception, which began around November 28th. Yes, sir. And so today we want to talk about a request that this board made relative to bus operators' assault. And this was information from the last quarter where there were 28 bus operators' assaults, and we were asked to show jurisdictional-wise where they came from. And you can see that D.C. had 19 assaults, Maryland had 7 assaults, Virginia had 2, and only 2 of the 28 assaults were reported as workers' comp. So the actions that precipitated caused someone to lose some time. Most of these were spits, throwing of paper, bottles, things of that nature. And so from a quarter comparison in FY 2010, the third quarter of March, from January to March, there were 15. The fourth quarter from April to June, there were 27. And the first quarter of July, there were 28. Next slide. With these 28 assaults, there were 5 arrests, and these were on-scene arrests that were made either by the transit police or the jurisdictional law enforcement agencies. So 32% of these cases, which were 9, were directly as a result of a fare dispute. So it was a fare dispute that caused the whole assault to take place. This is a depiction of our Metro stat.
Chief, question on the bus assaults related to, are you trending where they're occurring on similar lines or similar locations? And are we, I know you started some time ago undercover police on some of the routes. Is that continuing? And just give us some feel for how many undercover police you have out there?
We have roughly 18 to 20 law enforcement officers who can work in plain clothes or uniforms. The majority of our crimes against bus operators or the crimes against buses take place in the southeast quadrant of the D.C. So that's where we have the preponderance of our crimes, whether it's throwing missiles at a bus, the windows, things of that nature, and we deploy to those locations where we have the majority of the activities during those particular times.
So I have a follow-up, Mr. Chairman. A follow-up to that. The arrest rate, 18%, not real good. Not necessarily, obviously, reflection on our police work, but the difficulty of making arrests. What, if anything, are you missing to help increase that number? And one of the reasons why this pie chart is important is the district has some of the toughest laws for convictions, and as we discussed at our last meeting, of course, we have to get a conviction for that to apply. So what is the biggest challenge in making more arrests in these cases?
Most of these assaults are those that aren't actual assaults that are taking place at that particular time. They don't involve the weapon, so the response to that is of a normal response. It's not an expedited lights and sirens and things of that nature. So the odds are catching the person who's actually in the process of assaulting the bus operator at the time is lessened. If, in fact, it's an assault with a gun or a knife or something that sort of necessitates a quicker response, and all jurisdictional agencies are notified to respond at that time.
Well, I asked the question. I guess I'll go back to a discussion we had on a previous item about, you know, how are we trending compared to other agencies in this area? Because I understand the urgency of some of these, but by the same token, you know, these are our employees, and you know, you might not want to call out the cavalry for somebody being spit, but it certainly is, you know, a concern for our employees and something that, you know, is there some level of cooperation that we need to increase with them in communicating some of these issues? Or, you know, what, I mean, obviously you've looked at these, and if there are things we need to be doing, I know we have, you know, camera capabilities in some cases, and I'm just trying to get an idea as to, is there something we can do to increase the arrest rate from 18%?
Absolutely. We rely heavily upon our jurisdictional law enforcement partners, and so they are well aware that when the call that comes out, in all probability, they will be the first one to respond to the call. We cover the Metro Transit Police 1,500 square miles, and we have roughly 10 patrol scout car sectors that are responsible for that 1,500 square miles. So the probability of the Metro Transit Police getting there is very low, but the probability of a jurisdictional agency is much higher. And so they've been working with us diligently to respond to calls for service that we, when we contact them.
It's a camera question again. What's the possibility of capturing some of this on camera? Or are we able to, or do we ever?
To go back to the question, we also work diligently with the respective union, 689. We go out to all of the bus divisions, so we do, in fact, take any assaults against our employees very seriously, and we try to work to mitigate those. Relative to the cameras, we do have buses, roughly 2,900 buses, that have some type of equipped cameras, and so it's incumbent upon us to make sure, one, that the cameras are working functional, that they are working, that we can retrieve that video, which entails another big issue that we are faced with, how to retrieve that information so that we can follow up and prosecute someone. So we do utilize those cameras very, very much for both criminal activity as well as accidents that involve our buses and things of that nature.
Can we wrap up quickly now?
Sure, sure.
We will have a long discussion.
So this is just
future meeting,
a two-week trending of our crimes, and it's going up. This time of year, we are more prone to have an increase in crimes, whether it's robbery, snatches, things of that nature. Next slide. So overall crime is down about 15% compared to the same time frame last year. Crime against persons have increased by 25%, and that constitutes many of the robberies, snatches of iPods, things of that nature. Crimes against properties risen 6%, but the thefts from autos have decreased over 50%, and vandalism in parking lots has doubled. That's double only from 5 to 10. This is a depiction of crimes against persons, and you'll see in the category of assaults, the various types of assaults, whether it's aggravated assault on a police officer, simple assault, which you see has increased by 30. That represents a lot of the juveniles, the fights that take place, the spitting of the on the bus operators, things of that nature. Going back to the robberies, which is another big issue, whether it's force and violence, robbery, pickpocket, or snatches, they make up roughly 50 some odd cases, but we're tracking a little bit more this year than we were at the same time last year. Next slide. Again, crimes against properties. We focus on the thefts from the parking lots, from the bicycles, things of that nature, and we all know that those parking facilities, which number in the upwards of 65,000 spaces, constitute the majority of our crime in that area.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just wanted to thank the Chief for this breakout. It's very, very helpful to know that for these types of crimes, where they are occurring and what kinds of crimes they are. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot. I think that roughly concludes the presentation.
Any questions for the Chief? Any other business for the committee? If not, we'll stand adjourned.